Hello and welcome to another Packaging Europe podcast. I'm your host, Victoria Hattersley, and just to give you a bit of background, I've been looking into the subject of novel feedstocks for packaging materials, which show the most promise, but perhaps most important, what kind of enabling conditions we need to scale them. Now, this can be bioplastics, paper-based, or something else entirely. We're being fairly materials agnostic here. For this podcast, I wanted to look more specifically at the crucial role of investment in this. So I've invited along Frederick Petit from Emerald, who will no doubt already be known to some of our listeners and is certainly a familiar face to us, having taken part in our Sustainable Packaging Summit last year. So I think Emerald are really salient to this conversation because they are a venture capital firm, but also an open innovation partner. I think that's right, isn't it, Frederick?
That's great.
Working specifically with startups in the green economy. So warm welcome to Frederick, and thank you so much for giving us your time once again. I hope you're not heartily sick of us Packaging Europe people by now. To start things off, I wondered if we could maybe try to provide some context for our listeners who may not be as familiar with the subject as to why it can be so difficult to scale up some of these more innovative or perhaps niche feedstocks for packaging materials. What barriers do researchers, companies and the industry as a whole face, Frederick?
Yeah, thank you, first of all, Victoria, for having me in today's podcast. And it's a pleasure talking to you about this this relevant topic. And it's indeed a very challenging topic. I mean, it's clear that the industry, and especially also the packaging industry, is looking for alternatives, especially for petrol-based virgin plastics. Because of regulations, because of consumer demand, because of shareholders' pressure. So then the likely alternative is to say, okay, how can we find alternatives? And today we're not going to discuss about alternatives coming from recycled plastics. So about the reuse, the chemical recycling, and the mechanical recycling, but we go more going to use about the novel feedstocks. Mm. And as you say, you have a couple of options. I mean, if you look at the total landscape of polymers, you include also a lot of the functional polymers, which include paper starch and bio-based functional polymers. And there you have the, for me, three main buckets. So you could go to fiber-based, and that's an ongoing trend. So where can we replace especially flexible plastic packaging by fiber-based packaging? And again, then you get also to barriers, but these barriers are more related to barrier properties related to oxygen transmission rates and vapor transmission rates. Or you can go to alternative bio-based polymers. And if you look into the bio-based polymer subject, as people know, you have two different options. So either you have bio-based pathways to existing building blocks. So if you look at polyethylene, you can produce polyethylene for petrol, you can produce polyethylene from sugarcane, but then you produce an existing plastic from a bio-based feedstock. There are some other options. I mean, as you might know, in the polyester space, you can produce one of their monomers, the monoethylene glycol, and from a bio-based route, and then you keep the other building block, the paraxylene, petrol-based. And again, you have a copy of the existing PET based from a different source. There you have a challenge on upstream, but you have less of a challenge downstream because the product is known in the market and people know where to use it and what the properties are. The third option is that you come up with a completely new bio-based polymer. And there, of course, the main example is PLA, but others are PHA or PBS or PTT. These are new polymers that are fully or partly bio-based. And they have the double challenge. So they have the challenge upstream. So how do I find and identify the right feedstocks? How do I convert them? How do I ultimately come up with a performing polymer? But then they have the second challenge, that this polymer is new to the market. So which means that before a customer will adopt this new polymer, they have do need to do a lot of testing because they need to understand exactly what does this product offer, what are the properties, what are the right applications. So these are some of the barriers that you see. You have the fiber-based part, you have the existing polymers with a bio-based feedstock, and then you have the new bio-based polymers, and they all have their own challenges.
And what do you think about some of the more niche feedstocks, I suppose? We hear a lot about, you know, algae-based packaging now, or mycelium derived from mushrooms and so on. Do the same kind of, are there more barriers for these kinds of materials? I know they're probably not nearly as scalable, for example.
Yeah, well, for me, they would fall under this third bucket. So okay. It's new materials to the market, yep. Materials that we have not seen today. They are bio-based, they are renewable. Mm. Depending on the product you talk about, they might also be compostable, either home compostable or industrial compostable, potentially degradable, potentially marine biodegradable. So we don't want any materials to end up in nature or in the oceans, but we have
that
to
word
face
potentially though, isn't it?
Yeah, we have to face reality. In some parts of the world, the collection systems are not yet on the required level. And if you know there is a high risk that your packaging material could end up being littered, then biodegradability could be a temporary solution. So this fungi-based materials, the algae-based, the seaweed-based, they all have a very solid story. And the fungi are often produced from waste. The algae and seaweed take up a lot of carbon dioxide. And you're right, they might have the challenges also on the upscaling. Mm. But they also have the second challenge. So they are new to the market. So you need to spend a lot of time and effort in identifying the right applications. And even if you talk about algae or seaweed, it's not one product. I mean, if you talk about PLA, then you say, okay, it's polylactic acid derived from lactic acids. And of course, you have different grades of polylactic acid, but you know what the family of materials is. If you look at seaweed and algae, it's a family of different materials. And if you want to use it in packaging, and especially in food packaging, you get not only the questions from the customers. So how about its functionality? What is the mechanical properties? What's the tear resistance? What's the strength of the elongation? On top, you get what are the barrier properties, as mentioned. So what is the OTR? What is the MPTR? And on top, you might guess the question, is it food approved if you want to use it for food packaging? So there are quite some challenges to overcome to bring these products to the market.
Yeah, and a lot to think about, obviously. I'm really interested in this notion of gap analysis and what this can tell us about where specifically investment is lacking and how we can kind of bridge that gap between really important early stage research and large scale industry uptake. I wondered if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, well, you mentioned in the introduction, Victoria, that Emerald Technology Ventures, we are not a pure venture capital player. We are as much an open innovation partner.
Yeah.
So our business model is that we work with some 50 plus corporates from around the world. That are looking for relevant startups, and not necessarily startups they immediately want to invest in, but they startups they want to collaborate with. And if you look from the startup side, if you are a startup, you have your ID, you have your technology, you might have your first patent, and then you need capital. But on the same time, you need customers, you need partners, you need to have ideas about the applications, you want to have proof of concept projects together with big corporates. So that's what we do with our team. We assess many startups, more than 2,000 a year. And with each of our corporate partners, we discuss the ones that we believe are relevant for business needs. So what are their challenges? What are they looking for open innovation? And many of the corporates we talk to have very strong carbon reduction targets. So they're all eager to learn more about anything which is bio-based, which is seaweed-based, which is algae-based. And there is a much stronger interest than before. But interest is not enough. And so beyond the interest, we really try to support the corporates as well as the startups to set up collaboration projects so that customers, so the brand owners, the converters, the raw material suppliers can test these materials from the startups to see how what their performance is, also to give feedback to the startup on where they see they would like to see some improvement and changes in the properties. This could be paid for projects, so that's also an income stream for the startups. There are a lot of grants available today from especially also in Europe for the European Commission, but also now more in the US. So that's a way how the startup can further grow. And then when you come to the purely venture capital, there is another challenge indeed, because most of the venture capital firms, when they decided to invest in a startup, they want to see a possible exit within, let's say, a 5-year time frame. If you want, I can give you one example of a company we invested in last year.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you.
So that is the company Genesis Biotech, located in Toronto, Canada. They are producing polyhydroxyalkanoates. And PHAs are not new. I mean, they have been around for some time. And we have been monitoring this space for a long time. And we were always a little bit critical because of the issues that we just mentioned. We got excited about what Genesis Biotech brings to the put it to the table because they have found a way where they could work with biogas producers who turn organic waste into biogas. That's an existing practice. And they have a bolt-on technology where you take out the fatty acids from the organic waste and turn them into the PHAs, and especially into the more performing PHAs, being the PHBVs. Also, the PHAs is a family of polymers, and the PHBVs are the more performing part of this family.
Okay.
And the remainder material is fed back into the biogas production. So we got excited because in this process, Genesis has addressed the feedstock question related to PHA. So they're not using any food source, but they are using food waste, so a waste stream. They have addressed to extend the performance of the PHAs, focusing on the higher end PHBVs. And they've also addressed, and that's a very important topic for the for all the novel feedstocks that we are discussing, is the CAPEX, so the capital expenditure investment challenge. So in this case, there are no hundreds of millions required to build a large dedicated facility to produce the PHAs, but it's a bolt-on technology that an existing biogas producer can install in its plant, and that's how they take out the PHAs. So we believe, and that's why we invested in Genesis, that they have addressed the feedstock challenge, the performance challenge, and also the cost challenge. And yeah, we are supporting them to see how also with our corporate partners to get their material tested and identify the right applications.
Okay, so I mean, the fact that it's a bolt-on technology then, and presumably is the most salient thing here, because it kind of sidesteps some of those financial issues that you're talking about, and also I guess the fact that they're using waste, crop waste. So I know there's a lot of questions around using food stocks to create materials.
You're right, Victoria. I mean, we talk to a lot of players in the industry, and they do not want to use any material which is taking food sources.
No,
they just want to stay away from any competition with the food chain whatsoever. So using a waste stream, of course, makes it also a more circular business model.
Okay, thank you. So, I mean, presumably Emerald's approach then differs from that of other venture capital firms in that you're working much more as a partner in innovation?
So we are indeed an open innovation partner for the industry, and as you know, we have launched a dedicated sustainable packaging fund, really focusing on addressing the challenges in the packaging value circle. And there, as open innovation partner, we are the matchmaker between startups and corporates for collaborations, for joint development agreements, for commercial agreements, for whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Next, we are a venture capital firm. So we, out of those 2,000 startups that we assess every year, we try to identify the most promising ones where we go in deep diligence and bring in our financial specialists next to our sector specialists or the people with a technical background. And if we decide to invest in a startup, so to take a minority equity position, we also, similar to other VCs, target and potential exit within the five-year timeframe. And then this way, we provide our corporate partners with a financial return on their investment from the VC activities, but most of our corporate partners work with Emerald because the strategic returns we provide, so the insights, the know-how, and the introductions to the relevant startups.
Brilliant, thank you. So that's pretty instructive, kind of giving an individual example of one of the companies that you're working with. But if we take a bit of a step back, I'll hopefully, for the article I'll be writing to accompany this, be talking to researchers and startups in various kinds of feedstocks. But I'm wondering what the wider kind of industry-wide enabling conditions, apart from greater investment, are needed to scale up these non-fossil-based feedstocks.
Well, that's a very fair question, Victoria. And the basic answer is that fossil-based feedstocks today are still extremely cheap. Mm. They are produced in fully optimized plants with a nameplate capacity of 100, 200, 400 kilotons a year. There's a lot of discussions about the oil prices not being high enough, conversion being too low. So that's the main challenge. The main challenge is that they need to compete with existing materials, which are extremely competitive and performing for the applications. So what is changing? Of course, we also, as Packaging Europe, you have been covering the PPWR on a regular basis.
Yes.
That's driving a lot of changes. Also, the UN Global Plastics Treaty, which is being negotiated, is driving changes. So you see that the whole packaging value circle is waking up to the, if you don't act, the threats, if you do act, the opportunities provided by this new regulations. But I think they are paramount, together potentially with some carbon taxation, to make the price competitive landscape more interesting for the bio-based solutions. Today, it's extremely difficult for them to compete with the incumbent materials.
It does seem that we're in a kind of a time of flux at the moment.
Excellent. You're fully right. I mean, we track the number of startups in the packaging space. I mean, there's never been a better time for a startup in the packaging space than today. I mean, a couple of years ago, you had to be in software as a service in order to be sexy and attract investments.
But yes, today, you're right.
But today you see, when you have a new raw material, a bio-based material, you have a new coating, you have a new barrier, you have a new additive, the whole digitalization of packaging. You see the number of startups in this space increasing every year. And also the number of investments made in packaging relevant startups has been increasing over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's as much as we're in quite alarming times, it's also, as you say, there are far wider opportunities than before, which I suppose we have to see as a positive thing. Thank you. I mean, all we talked about so far is really crucial stuff, but I'd like to wrap things up, as I kind of always do, maybe with a bit of practical advice specifically for startups or maybe researchers. Given your kind of extensive experience in this area, how can they go about attracting industry investment or interest if they haven't yet done so?
Yeah, so it starts with technology. What is your innovation? What do you bring to the market? I mean, as mentioned, we view a lot of startup pitch decks, and many of them still start with 10 pages that there is so much plastic use in the world, and these are all the issues, and these are the challenges. I think at this point we know. So I'm more curious to see what are you going to present about your own technology. What do you bring to the market? That's first. So what is your invention, and do you have it patented, or do you have other ways you have it protected? Then you need to get a picture about what is your attainable market. So for which market, for which applications, for which customers is your invention potentially relevant? Is it for a niche application, or will you be able to have an alternative for a much larger volume? Where are you with your technology venture, with your technology development? So often referred to as which TRL level are you? Have you proven it just in the lab, or did you already have a small pilot plant? Do you already have some customer referrals? And then we realize that today your cost price linked to your production capacity will be high, but what is your outlook, and how will you get there? At what volume will you be able to offer your product, at what price? And then comes the next question: what is the capital required to get there? And be very open, be very clear. It's not easy to get these answers, and sometimes we also can help you to get these answers. And as mentioned earlier, as a startup in this space, you need the capital. But next to the capital, you need the support. I mean, we see very young founders, entrepreneurs. We love them, but they might need also some support on business models, on business potential, on fundraising, on the commercial side. And thirdly, next to the financial support and the coaching support, they need these big friends. So they need these corporates as suppliers, as manufacturing partners, as research partners, or as customers. And there you need to have the right entry points. And this often takes a lot of time for the startups to find the right people to talk to in this large organizations. And there it's wise to talk to organizations like Emerald or others who can help you identify the right entries in the relevant corporates.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's hard to kind of overstate how important the role is that companies such as yours play, because it feels like it's something of a paradox, I suppose. Startups, they have far more ability to be agile and take risks and try something new, but at the same time they don't have the they don't have the backing, they don't have the capacity to kind of scale this or to even test it out sometimes. So it's kind of clear to see the role that you play there, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. I mean, in my previous life, I worked both at a corporate and I was a CEO of a startup. And that's then also you see how different these worlds are. Corporates are very serious. They take a long time. They have the budget. They have the resources. When a corporate says, "Okay, we will be quick," that means most likely they will do it the second half of the year or at the earliest. And when a startup says, "I'm quick," then he means, "Can we do it tomorrow or latest next Monday?" So there's also a cultural gap, and you need to be sensitive of that from both sides. You need to be sensitive from the corporate side, how startups tick, and you need to be sensitive from the startup side, how corporates tick. And if you have this insights and this understanding, then you can have very fruitful partnerships. If you don't have the sensitivities, then it can be quite frustrating. And especially today, I mean, 23 was not an easy year for startups for fundraising. 24 is getting a little bit better. So also you have to make sure that you start in time. Don't expect as a startup that you will be able to raise capital within a 3 months time frame. That's not realistic. Because if corporates or venture capital firms invest, they do their own diligence. They want to do a deep assessment of the company on the topics that we just mentioned. So the technology, the business model, the business potential, the value proposition, the timelines, the required capital, etc. So as a startup, start early and identify the right partners you want to work with that can support you on this journey.
Thank you. And just another quick one, going on from what you said. You said 23 was particularly difficult. Is there any reason why you expect 24 may be slightly easier in this regard?
Well, in 23, it's for sure the economic outlook was very uncertain. We had the raw material prices, we had the inflations, we had the logistic challenges, the geopolitical tensions. So many corporates, especially, were reluctant to spend a lot of money on the long term. So they were very much looking at optimizing their bottom line for the year itself. And working with a startup is not improving your bottom line for the same year. Working with a startup is improving your bottom line in time frame of 3 or 4 years when the startup gets to maturity and you will be able to use their material for some of your applications. You see that in 24, I mean, we still live in an VUCA world, but it seems to be a little bit less uncertain than last year. Inflation has dropped a little. So you see that corporates, also to be prepared for new events to happen, realize that they need to have some technology options available. And you see again a bit growing interest in open innovation and in working with startups.
I see. No, that makes perfect sense. Well, sadly, I think that's about all we have time for today. So I'd just like to thank you again for your time, Frederick, and it's been great to speak with you. And as always, thank you to our listeners as well. And please look out for the article accompanying this podcast on the premium section of our website, where I'm going to delve a little deeper into the subject of scaling innovative feedstocks. And I also hope to speak to Genesis, which is the company that Frederick was talking about earlier. We will set that up, won't we, Frederick?
Yeah, I will make the required introductions.
Okay, fantastic. Well, goodbye everyone, and have a good day or evening wherever you are, and tune in again for next time.